A good example, well, first of all, let me say there's several factors that cause this shift, among which we're concerned with here, is the quality of the light on the scene itself. To give you an example of what the quality of the light has to do with color fidelity, as you know, on the market we have both indoor and outdoor color film. Now, if you use outdoor color film indoors, you know, you get a red overcast in the film, in your image. Or if you use indoor-outdoor, you get a blue. This is not what we want. Need I say, we want true representation of the color. Now, all color films presently on the market of the outdoor type are designed for use here on Earth, where you have not only the sun illuminating the subject, you also have the sky, which is a predominantly blue, which gives you somewhat of a blue overcast to your subject matter. Now, in space, we don't have the sky. We have only the sun. So therefore, we do have a different quality, let me say, of light on your subject matter. So what we want to determine here is what filtration is required to correct this shift that will occur in this photography we take on the moon. Now, the way we're going to do that is by photographing a calibrated target. Here's a model of the target that they will carry into space. It contains the primary colors plus the gray. The slate here will be returned to the photographic laboratory in Houston along with the film. And the printer will take the imagery of the patch, put it in the enlarger, print it, and you'll make the color of the print match this of the plate itself. And he will note down in his notebook the amount of filtration or the types of filters they use to achieve this. This will be kept in file so when we get the Apollo photography return, we can again use these particular filters to achieve our goal of a good color quality in Apollo photography.
We're ready for questions on this experiment here, please. Go ahead, Mary. Right up front here, Bob.
How do you determine, how does it affect geology?
Well, the geologists tell me the color is an important key to the chemistry of the rocks that you photograph.
Go ahead, George.
Are you using, what sort of film are you using? Is it specially prepared?
Oh, it'll be the SO217, which is similar to your SO217, which is an Eastman product, and it's similar to your Ektachrome, which you find on the shelf item. 125, if I recall.
Do we have any questions in Houston on this experiment, please? No questions in Houston? Okay, I guess that completes the questions here, Bob.
Thank you, Bob. Next experiment is one that has been flown before, zodiacal light photography and other dim light photography. The experimenter is Dr. Edward Nye of the University of Minnesota, and Mr. James Stoddard, one of his associates, is here to talk about what they're going to do on this flight with this experiment. Jim?
The University of Minnesota Zodiacal Light Experiment is one of the continuing experiments on Gemini. We've flown on GT5, 8, 9, and now on 10. And basically, I think all of you know what the hardware looks like. You've heard us talk about it. It's a panoramic-type camera that takes a field of view of 150 degrees by 50 degrees. It's fully automatic, fully automated, so that all the astronaut has to do is turn a switch on, and the camera takes a 30-second exposure and advances the film automatically for him. We've been running a sort of a survey on the airglow phenomena, which happens about 65 kilometers above the Earth, and coordinating that with our OSO, orbiting solar observatory data, trying to find patches of higher intensity and so forth. Zodiacal light, of course, is another phenomena that's basically concerned with the dust that's in the solar plane or the plane of the ecliptic. And we have now pictures of the refraction of the light, reflection of the sunlight in the early morning on this pile of dust or group of dust. And some of our grad students now are starting to put the numbers into the computers and figuring out how many rocks are out there and just how they're distributed. Actually, on Gemini 9, we were supposed to have pictures taken outside the spacecraft without the benefit of the spacecraft window. However, Gene Cernan had a few small problems out there and didn't quite accomplish the pictures outside the spacecraft. However, he took us 17 of the most beautiful pictures we've ever seen of both the early morning zodiacal light, the air glow layers, a couple of good shots of the Milky Way, morning zodiacal light. And this time we're asking Mike to take us 6 shots of the evening zodiacal light, which will be 6 shots to the west, then to swing the spacecraft around and map the Milky Way for us, starting at the southern horizon. If you can think of the southern horizon to 150 degrees above the spacecraft, it's a little bit overhead. Then he's going to rotate the spacecraft to the zenith angle and take another shot for us, on over to the north and take 2 more shots for us. Then start a mapping program of the air glow layer again from the northeast, east, hopefully picking up some of the morning zodiacal light, and then swing around to the south where we hope to see some auroral activity. And Mike is going to leave the camera running until he sees the stars start to extinguish, which will give us some more good astronomical numbers about the environment they're in out there. I do have 2 pictures that were taken by Cernan on Gemini 10. these, of course, are down. The information here is probably 1,000 times less than we actually have on the flight film. This being the nose of the spacecraft, the Earth's limb down underneath the air glow and the air glow layer, and this is the Milky Way. This is commonly called the cold sack, or the coldest, the darkest spot in the Milky Way, and this is the constellation Cygnus, or the kite. As you can see, there are a lot of, it was a very good hold. There are some rings around the stars, and this indicates well, I can't think of the name of it. I get thing. Pardon?
Diffraction.
Yeah, it's a diffraction pattern around the star. This isn't quite the word I was thinking of, but it's quite correct.
What's that bright feature up around 11 o'clock there?
This one?
Yeah.
That's a star. That's a first magnitude star, and of course there's quite a bit of coma around that. Coma is the word I was looking for. There's quite a bit of coma around that, but you can see that the astronauts have the facility of holding the spacecraft very well. Actually, this picture in reality is something of like about this high, but the common, ordinary, run-of-the-mill paper you get is this size, so we settle for this much of it to show you. Actually, the information that we use is taken from the actual flight film. We run it through a micro isodensity tracer, which plots light levels versus angular displacement, and it gives us a actual illumination value. These are just so we can talk about what these things actually look like. Here's the case I was telling you, the morning sunrise. This being Venus out here, the planet Venus. And this is the zodiacal light and the air glow layer down here. And you can see that the air glow layer is now just starting to burn through the zodiacal light is just starting to burn through in twilight here. And so this is pretty much as close to the sun as you can get when you're taking these pictures. You can also see that there is just a little bit of spacecraft motion out here. The coma makes it look a lot worse, but if you look closely, you'll see that the star is just a small line out there. Any questions?
How long were those exposures? Was that 10 seconds?
No, these are 30-second exposures. There's a 10-second, yes. 10 seconds. No, it's 15 seconds. Our lens covers just about half of the field at one time, so it's effectively a 15-second exposure.
Do you mean that Venus really looks that bright in space, or is that some distortion of the picture?
Well, of course, that's some distortion of the picture, but I would assume that Venus would look quite bright. There's a lot of coma around that, of course. it almost looks like the moon in this particular picture, but I'm sure that it's overexposure of the film, just due to the coma effect.
Do we have any further questions here? Go ahead, Mary. All right, well, go ahead, since you've got it right there. I'm sorry, I didn't see it.
Yeah. Why, has there been any photography, do you know whether any of the astronauts have seen the southern aurora? They go how far? 33 degrees to the south, don't they, on that?
I believe this question has been asked of them, and I don't think that any of them have said they have seen it.
Possible to see it from that altitude at that latitude, the lowest, at the highest latitude that they go?
The highest?
South.
Yes.
It is. I understand in the past pictures there were some plumes or something like that observed above the Erico layer, and that you were quite interested in investigating them further. Could you give us some details on why they're so interesting?
Well, Basically, you think of the Erico layer as being a smooth surface above the Earth, and the astronauts have been telling us that there are these plumes out there. And for the first time on Gemini 9, we did see some evidence of plumes. I don't think there's any explanation yet as to what they are or how they form, but this is something new that we've seen, and we hope, hopefully, on this flight we'll see some more, and maybe this will then some ideas as to what causes them and how they get there, how bright they are. No, we don't this time.
I understand we have a question in Houston. We'll now switch to Houston.
Did the Gemini 9's dark light experiment note any strongly scattered light in the vicinity of the spacecraft? And if so, what effect would this have on astronomical photography, as Dr. Heinz mentioned earlier, by manned spacecraft?
Yes, actually, Gemini 9 had almost a full moon, and some of our pictures of the Milky Way did show evidence that there was a cloud of dust surrounding the spacecraft, or corona. We have started making measurements on this to determine just how bright this is and of what consequence it is. However, this type of measurement takes some time, and we just don't have the hard numbers yet. There is some evidence, though, of a dust cloud around, or a spacecraft corona, however you want to call it.
Do we have any indication as to what is the cause of this strongly scattered light in the vicinity of the spacecraft? And again, if Dr. Heinz would answer, what effect, if any, this would have on future plans for manned astronomical observatories?
First, the evidence.
Yes. I think the easiest way to describe the evidence, we were taking pictures up quite close to the moon itself. We know that the spacecraft window through which we were taking pictures did not have moonlight directly on it. However, there were indications that the moon was not too far off the field, which therefore you have to assume that there's something around the spacecraft reflecting light that our camera could see. Because if there isn't any actual direct light on the spacecraft window, then you shouldn't, in theory, see this. However, there was in the corner of the frame, a high light level indicating that there was something surrounding the spacecraft that the moonlight shining on it could be photographed. This was clumsily put, but this is generally what happened. I think maybe Dr. Heinz would...
This is Carl Henaez again of Northwestern University concerning the effects on astronomical photography. this is the reason we're not asking them to photograph our stars in a daytime in a daytime environment. The main problem will be the scattered light, which would fog the film. And at nighttime, there is no scattered light from the sun to bother us. The amount of particles or gas is fairly unknown, and so far as we can determine, there's going to be no absorption aspect of this material to bother us. Again, we are also taking very short exposures, looking at very bright stars, and in this particular program, I'm sure there will be no effect, but it is a problem that concerns us when we think about bigger telescopes with longer exposures. It will be a concern to us, and we're very anxious to find out exactly the nature of this, if it exists. It's an important thing to know.
Go ahead, Bill. I think that, does that complete the questions from Houston?
We do not know what the what has caused the scattered light. We think it's perhaps a cloud, but we don't know exactly what the what is the makeup of this cloud that has caused a strongly scattered light in the vicinity of the spacecraft. Is that correct?
Dr. Hemingway would comment.
I'd like to ask a question first before commenting. Can you be sure of how far away the light scattering objects are from the spacecraft from your measurements?
No, that's true. We can't, Dr. Hemingway. We did run an experiment down in Houston in the spacecraft that's down there, and using a light source to be a mock-up of the moon, we were unable to get any of this phenomena in the camera, so we know it has to be something outside the spacecraft.
But can you be sure how far away from the spacecraft? Could it be potentially a dust cloud in the vicinity of the Earth that you're observing by this technique?
Well, I think you're going to have to talk to Dr. Nye about that.
Are the experimentist questions completed here? Mr. Hines?
Yes, on this S1 experiment, if I read the flight plan correctly, you do the whole thing with the hatch cover closed, and I'm wondering why this is not done, at least part of it, with the hatch cover open.
Well, apparently it's a time problem here of how long they're going to have that hatch open. We'd like to have it that way, but there's a certain amount of time they can have that hatch open, and we're just not in that group this time. Sorry about that.
Okay, we are coming up about an hour, and we have a number of more experimenters, so let's proceed at this point. Go ahead, Bob.
The next two experiments, S10 and S12, are both micrometeorite experiments, and Dr. Curtis Hemingway of Dudley Observatory is the principal investigator on both. They both involve open hatch or EVA, and Dr. Hemingway.
Thank you, Bob. I might say that we're interested in looking and collecting by various techniques the particles which presumably are the same particles that are observed as are responsible for scattering the zodiacal light. We've in the past been working with balloon top techniques and rocket techniques to actually physically collect these particles. In the case of the satellite experiments, we're more concerned with the interaction that these particles have with various surfaces that we expose. We're exposing thin films to see the holes that the micrometeorite particles make when they go through the thin films. We're also exposing various optical surfaces, glass, and so on. In the last flight, Gemini 9, we got some very exciting results, at least exciting to us. The exposure was twice what we had anticipated we would get prior to the flight. There are a number of hole structures that we've seen. I'll just show you one here quickly. Where objects have clearly had a velocity signature and have penetrated the thin films. There are some classes of objects which may possibly represent a higher velocity impact. We're not sure yet what this funny eye-like structure represents. We've never seen anything like this before on the rocket and balloon top collections. It may possibly represent a hypervelocity impact with a thin film. The other thing that surprised us about the S12 collection experiment on Gemini 9 was the fact that the surfaces were quite dirty after the exposure. I have here a low magnification picture which you can't see, but if you look at it afterwards, you'll find there's lots of dust on this thing, and it's possible that this is the same material that Mr. Stoddard has been talking about. We were startled to find so much material in the vicinity of the spaceship. Well, the to turn briefly to the equipment, the S-12 experiment is mounted on the target docking adapter of the Gemini spacecraft. This is the box. It has a motor within, batteries, and there are two compartments, one a sterile compartment and the other one a non-sterile compartment, in which various exposure experiments are being carried out. There's some 24 slides in this box. I won't open it for you as the astronauts will. I don't have the control unit with me, but you can see the places where the slides go. This is actually the environmental test unit that was used in the flight qualification of the hardware. The other, this experiment then hopefully will have two exposures during astronaut sleep periods, and we may end up with the order of 16 hours direct space exposure of a wide variety of experiments. Let me turn briefly to the other experiment. This is the hardware, the S-10 hardware. You notice that there are collection plates or impact plates on the outside. These are stainless steel plates. And on the inside, there are a wide variety of surfaces. I won't attempt to describe all of them to you and the purposes of the various experiments. Some of them are optical glass, some of them stainless steel, some of them are thin nitrocellulose collection experiments. Another one over here in the lower left to you is a microbiological exposure experiment. I might say, by the way, that we got some very exciting results in the microbiological exposure field in the S-12 experiment, too. It turned out last time that three of the four microorganisms had significant survival, small but still significant. The tobacco mosaic virus survived in the order of 2 parts per 1,000, and this was much larger than we'd ever would have guessed ahead of time. Two of the other organisms also had significant exposure survivals. Now, the S-10 experiment was put on the Gemini 8 Agena. However, with the problems of the thruster of Gemini 8, why, they were unable to get to it to open it up. So the Gemini 8 S-10 unit looks something like this. It does have these wonderful, very highly polished stainless steel plates on the outside, and we're hopeful that in this mission that astronaut Collins can go to the Agena and recover this for us. He also will be carrying up with him another unit of this type, and hopefully will substitute it in place of the one that's there, only leave it in the open and exposed orientation, where there's some 8 or 9 different experiments and can be subjected not to a 18-hour exposure, but instead to an exposure of perhaps as long as 4 months, if we're lucky, and get the equipment back. So the S-10 experiment is one which places the major emphasis on impacts, studying the craters that the micrometeorite particles make with when they hit the surfaces. The S-12 is a shorter duration exposure. We'd hoped that, we'd expected at least, that the S-12 experiment would provide a short duration exposure which would be cleaner than the S-10. However, as I say, we're very startled by the debris that we got on the S-10 experiment and wonder if we're not observing a contamination from the spacecraft, potentially perhaps the same material that Mr. Stoddard has been talking about. Now, one last thing, the experiment S-12 is a one which we're sharing space with a large number of organizations. There are 10 different organizations, including my own, which are flying experiments on this one hardware. Dr. Yuri Shafrir, the University of Tel Aviv, the director of the Space Science Institute there, has a slide. Dr. Hugo Fechtig of the Max Planck Institute at Heidelberg also has space. And I, there are also six other investigators in this country, Air Force Cambridge Research Lab, Goddard Space Flight Center, Manned Spacecraft Center, U.S. Geological Survey, Smithsonian Observatory, and University of Washington is sharing an experiment, Ames Research Center. And I have with me one of the foreign experimenters, Dr. John Kerridge from Birkbeck College at the University of London, and he is one of the guest scientists who are sharing space on this experiment this next time. And I'd like to introduce him to you, and perhaps to symbolize the type of experiment that we're doing, he might describe a little bit about what he is up to. This is Dr. John Kerridge from Birkbeck College of the University of London. John?
Thank you, Kurt. Well, I'm interested in the dust which has been described as impacting on the spacecraft while it's in orbit. And my interest is really quite fundamental. I'm interested in trying to get some crystallographic information from these particles. At Birkbeck College, we have considerable crystallographic experience and in developing different techniques. And the object of this exercise is to try and determine partially the crystalline structure of such particles as we can pick up of extraterrestrial origin. Now, we know we aren't going to be getting very much crystalline information, that is, much information about the crystal structure, because the particles are very small, and the amount of such information that you can get from a particle is in direct proportion to the volume of it. And these very small particles will only give us really clues about their crystal structure. However, assuming that we can get some idea of the type of crystal structures present in space, we know from terrestrial observations that the crystal structures of minerals can provide very valuable genetic clues as to the processes which have gone on to form the minerals. And optimistically, the debris which we pick up in space on the outside of the spacecraft will be more primitive with respect to the age of the solar system than anything we have lying around on the Earth. The reasoning is that this material, this fine-grained material, will probably have been locked up for most of its time in space in either comet or the outer regions of some asteroids on which, well, perhaps geological is the wrong word to use, but processes will not have gone on to the same extent to alter the material as they have on Earth. So you might say that I'm hoping to step a little further back in the evolution of the solar system and try and get some idea of some more primitive, well, for want of a better word, geological processes.
Thank you, John. I might add that Dr. Kerridge is, I think, the first scientist from Great Britain to participate in the American manned space program. I think that's all I have to say if there are questions.
Before you start questions, there was a breakdown in communications with Houston. The investigator that was speaking was Dr. Curtis Hemingway of Dudley Observatories in Albany, New York. His experiments are S10 and S12, the micrometeorite experiments. I think they heard the rest. Questions?
If I understand Dr. Hemingway correctly, Collins will replace the experiment package that he has taken off Gemini 8 with another one that he is carrying up, and he'll put that on Gemini 8. And you said that that would probably be recovered about 4 months from now. This leads me to ask a question. I don't know whether you're the one to answer this or not. Does this imply that we are going to have a triple rendezvous on Gemini 12? Because it's already stated in here that in the press kit that the Gemini 10 spacecraft will probably be rendezvoused with by the Gemini, the Agena 10 spacecraft will probably be rendezvoused with by the Gemini 12 spacecraft. I'm wondering now how many rendezvous you're going to have. You want to tell us, Jack?
Well, number one, no, I don't know the answer to your question, Bill, number one, and I don't know whether Dr. Hemingway is the one to give an answer completely to the question, but perhaps he can make a comment on it. If he is not able to do it, we'll be glad. I think we could cover it this afternoon, I'm quite sure.
Let me say this, that I believe that the hope is that Gemini 12 will make the attempt to recover from the Eta Agena. The Eta Agena has been found to be quite stable in space, and it looks to be a suitable vehicle to attempt to rendezvous with when you can't actually perform the docking maneuver. We are actually putting the S10 collector also on the 10 Agena, and then we'll have two options, and whichever one is recovered will give us information.
You would like to recover both, I take it.
Well, I think we'll be very pleased if we get one of them back.
Let's try to get some announcement on that this afternoon.
Right. Well, I think that can be brought up at the properly brought up at the mission briefing, and We'll just, why don't we take it up at that time?
Yeah, the philosophy is, though, is to get these things up there when the opportunity presents itself, as many of them as we can.
And also get them back.
And get them, well, you can't get them back if you don't get them up there. So we're going to get them up there, and then as the flight planning goes on, we hope we'll get them back.
As you know, flight plans change with time, too, and it may well turn out that the 10 one is the one that we'll go after instead of the 8.
Go ahead, Dick.
Dr. Hemingway, as your indication about the survival of the viruses, tobacco mosaic viruses, has this been published?
No, it has not. We're still working on the data, and it will be published in the near future, however.
How significant is 2 parts per thousand?
Well, it's very significant when you compare the, when you consider the density of microorganisms that were exposed on each of the samples. We were exposing in the order of 10 to the 9th microorganisms per individual sample, so we had a large number survive.
But could
although
you say
a small fraction of the total which were exposed.
Could you say that 2 out of 1,000 survived? Would it be that simple?
I don't know what you mean by that simple.
Well, I mean, how does the ratio go when you say 2 parts per 1,000?
Yeah.
Would this be 2 critters per 1,000?
2 critters per 1,000.
One more thing.
That's the largest one, by the way. The I have the some other preliminary numbers here. The if I remember correctly, the others were in the order of 2 parts per million and 2 parts per 100,000. These are significant survivals. We're not sure of the mechanism by which these objects did survive. What this will tell us about problems of spaceship sterilization and, is yet to be
There's no knowledge,
about.
Isn't it? This has not been known before, that organisms could survive.
As far as I know, this is the first type of experiment where organisms have been directly exposed to the space environment. We've also, well, I shouldn't say that. This is the first time from a satellite this has been done. We have done this on 3 rocket flights, too, but the exposures there were only of the order of 3 minutes in each case. The thing that surprised us is that we got anything at all surviving. This was quite remarkable.
Does this discovery do anything with respect to this old panspermia theory of transportation of life forms between planets?
Well, there are many problems with that theory. You've got to get the microorganisms out of the planet, and it's presumably got to go out through an atmosphere, and this is a pretty difficult thing to do. It's like throwing a feather 100 miles, and this is kind of a difficult task. It does indicate that apparently that some organisms can survive. It is possible that the reason that we're seeing some survival is that the organisms are clustered, and it may be that the dead bodies of some of the organisms are shielding some of the live ones within. Maybe this is what we're observing. I think that it's an interesting effect, and it's one that we're going to pursue in depth in the future.
And are you going to try any more highly evolved forms of life than tobacco mosaic virus go up into the protozoa?
I doubt it. We're working with bacteria, viruses, and spores at the moment.
We are using bacteria, then.
Yes.
That was a 3-day exposure.
No, it was an 18-hour exposure, actually, a little less than 18 hours.
Just for curiosity, Doctor, what was the survival ratio on your 3-minute rocket exposure?
They were much higher, and we
Could
think
you give us a
that.
Number?
We can plot now curves indicating survival as a function.